Well, it's a pleasure having you here in person, because in my youth, of course, I read all of your early science fiction books, starting with Pebble in the Sky and all of the Foundation books. In some respects, it was kind of a bridge to a non-specific fiction. And, of course, you and Heinlein and Bradbury, A.E. Van Vogt, all of these writers were very influential. And looking back in the 1950s, when you first started writing all these science fiction books, I don't know, maybe it's just, I'm probably wrong about this, but it seems to me that it was almost like a golden age. There were so many great names that still hold up today, including your own.
Well, we think of it as a golden age, all right. Naturally, some people say that golden age happens to be whenever you're 12. But when John Campbell came in and became editor of Astounding Stories, he changed the name to Astounding Science Fiction and managed to dig up a whole group of new writers. And a lot of those writers still dominate the field. I mean, and it's nearly 50 years later. My first story was published in 1939, so that year after next, I celebrate my golden anniversary. And there are several others like myself. And we remember those days. It was a different world. There were only a few magazines that represented the total publication of science fiction, and only one of them was a class magazine. That was Astounding. And there were only a few dozen science fiction writers of note. We all knew each other. We were all poor together, because you didn't make much money. It was a penny a word. Eventually it went up to 2 cents a word, and nobody could do more than make a little pin money. My first 11 years as a successful science fiction writer, I made a total of $7,700. Not per year, for the entire 11 years, which wasn't to be sneezed at. It helped me finance my education. But still, you couldn't make a living and support a wife and children on that, but we were happy. Nowadays, of course, it's altogether different. There are hundreds of science fiction writers. Some of them can insist on six-figure advances. Some routinely get bestsellers. Right, bestsellers get on the lists. And in addition to magazines, there are an infinite number of novels, hardcover and softcover. And also there's a big market out there in Hollywood and on television. So that now it's quite possible to be a science fiction writer and rich.
John Campbell started Astounding Science Fiction back in the 1930s, but I have a feeling it started to come of age in the 50s. Is that your perception?
Well, what happened was that after World War II and the nuclear bomb, there was no longer a feeling that science fiction was just kid stuff, that it was just the sort of fairy tales for moderns. We had been writing stories about nuclear bombs and the disasters that might result for years, and then suddenly became real. And then in the 50s, they started talking about computers, started talking about rockets, and even putting something in orbit. And in fact, 1957, the first satellite went into orbit. So that we were living more and more in a science fiction world. And beginning with the 1950s, science fiction writers were taken seriously. I distinctly remember how astonished I was when I wrote an article on colonizing the moon, the same sort of article I would write for a science fiction magazine, except that this time it was printed in the New York Times Sunday magazine. They hadn't changed. I mean, I hadn't changed. They had. And then, in the 1960s, a new generation of science fiction writers came in that weren't interested primarily in machinery and technology of the future, but were interested in social structure, in characterization, and so on. What happened was that television had killed off a great many of the great fiction magazines. You know, the Saturday Evening Post, the Colliers, and the literary quarterlies went to wherever they go when they die. And even even novels, even ordinary fiction sort of declined somewhat. So that all the young men who ordinarily would try to write for the Saturday Evening Post or for the literary quarterlies, try to write great novels, found that there wasn't much market for fiction, and that one of the flourishing markets that remained was science fiction. So, faute de mieux, for lack of anything better, they went into science fiction, but they took with them their writing skills, their writing ambitions. So that nowadays, a person like myself is quite old-fashioned, and we have all kinds of stylistic experimental work, rather deeply layered fiction, you know, with several several levels of significance, not necessarily easy reading. My books are still quite easy to read. I tell them in straightforward fashion with a beginning, a middle, and end, because that's the way I'm used to it. And I don't feel like changing much. Fortunately, there are people who are willing to read my stuff.
Well, there's a new phenomenon, too, manifested by people like Piers Anthony, who have blended science fiction with fantasy, which seemed to me almost unheard of before.
Well, there always was a rather narrow division, but Tolkien, in the 1970s, was Lord of the Rings, breathed new life into fantasy, and made single-handedly made it a great market, so that even in my magazine, you know, I have a magazine of my own. It's been going now for about 11 years, Isaac Asimov Science Fiction Magazine. We started off intending to print only science fiction, straight science fiction, but some fantasy creeps in now and then. And whenever it does, why, we get letters from readers, some supporting us, some denouncing us. But and despite the fact that in my editorials, I'm always for good old-fashioned stories, we print a lot of the new variety. And we should. I mean, science fiction should be as broad as possible, I think, and shouldn't confine itself to the prejudices of any one man, even myself.
You've written scores and scores of books, but probably you'll always be best known for the Foundation series. Tell me how that developed in your mind so long ago. And you're still writing the Foundation.
Yes, not exactly voluntarily. I started the Foundation series back in 1942. When I was just 22 years old. The original notion in my head was to write a short story. I was just beginning then. I'd been a published writer for 3 years, perhaps, and every month I'd make a trip to John Campbell, the editor of Astounding, with an idea. And I came in with an idea for a short story about the fall of the Galactic Empire. And by the time he and I finished talking, it wasn't a short story. It was an endless series. He wanted me to write a history of the future, and I had the idea of psychohistory, sort of where someone could predict the future, at least statistically. And I started writing it, and by the time 8 years had passed, I had enough stories sold and published to fill 3 books. And just about the time I finished them, publishers began to publish hardcover science fiction. That was something entirely new. So that, although the magazine stories appeared in the 1940s, the 3 books, Foundation, Foundation Empire, and Second Foundation, came out 51, 52, and 53. But by that time, I was tired of the Foundation. I'd spent 8 years writing it and almost nothing else except for some robot stories, which came out as iRobot in 1950. I wanted to go on to other things, and I felt 3 books were enough. The only trouble was that new readers kept coming in, because there are always new youngsters who discover science fiction, and each generation in science fiction, we count 3 years to a generation, each generation of readers would pick up the Foundation trilogy and notice that it was unfinished. And I would get letters, and the publisher would get letters, and so on. After 32 years, after I had written what I thought was the last word, my publishers could take it no more. And they said, I just have to write another Foundation novel. And I was scared stiff. I mean, I'd written them in my 20s, Now I was in my 60s. I wasn't sure that I could still have that rough-hewn vigor. But I tried. I reread the Foundation Trilogy, which came completely new to me. I hadn't read it for 32 years. You know, it's like reading someone else's stuff. And it interested me, and I was sort of upset when I finished. I began instantly and wrote Foundation's Edge, which was the fourth novel of the trilogy. I've actually put it on the cover, the fourth novel of the Foundation Trilogy. I pointed out trilogy means three books. So they may change it to the fourth novel of the Foundation Saga, or series, that's what. And I wrote Foundation's Edge, and then a terrible thing happened. Got on the bestseller list, to my astonishment. Stayed there for 25 weeks. My publishers, Doubleday and Company, were jumping up and down, you know, instantly wanted me to write more books. So I wrote a couple of robot books to finish my robot novel series, which I'd also abandoned many years ago. And then I wrote the fifth book, Foundation and Earth, which has just come out in paperback, and it also made the bestseller list, I should say. Paperback also did. And then, after that, I wrote Fantastic Voyage 2, Destination Brain, which is my current novel.
Can we get to that for just a moment? I just want to go back to the Foundation books. Thank God for the Doubleday Science Fiction Club, because I have all of the I have the original three Foundation books as Science Fiction Book Club, and but I too haven't read them since the 1950s. So as you began reading these books, you said interesting, but how did they hold up in terms of writing?
Well, they must hold up. I'm no judge.
No, I know they hold up in terms of the concept and the idea and the sweep and the imagination, but in terms of the actual writing.
Ah, well, that depends on what you think of my writing. The people who don't particularly like the way I write say I haven't improved. And the people who do like the way I write say, gee, Asimov, you're keeping it up. I'm not a great stylist. I'm not a poetic typewriter. I aim at clarity. Of my 367 books, 200 are nonfiction, and my main job, in terms of both, is to present every branch of science to the lay reader, to say nothing of history and geography and mythology and literature and so on. I mean, immediately after this book that's out now, I've got Asimov's annotated Gilbert and Sullivan coming out. But in all my writing, my nonfiction writing, I have to be clear. I'm looking not for a specialized audience. I'm not writing to fellow intellectuals. I'm writing for the general public. And so clarity is what I aim for. And I do that in my fiction, too. I eschew fanciness of all kinds. Not for me, the unnecessary subordinate clause. I tell it straight. And while this appeals to lots of people and makes for easy reading, you can sit down and just lose yourself in the book, and then by the time you're finished, you realize you haven't slept for 48 hours. Some people don't think it's enough of a intellectual challenge or something, and they don't like it. But I write as I always did.
Well, you're a mature writer today. You were in your 20s when you started the Foundation. I would assume that as time goes on, one polishes his craft.
Well, and I think I have. But I have stayed so to speak, in the same place, polished what I've done before, made it still easier to read. My original novels were 70,000 words long. The novels I write now are, at editorial assistance, 140,000 words long. So the plots are more complicated. But the method of telling the story isn't. I still tell it straight.
You got your PhD from Columbia. You studied physics.
Chemistry.
And science fiction writing was a sideline, a hobby at the time.
Except that I started writing long before I was a chemist. By the time I got my PhD, I was an established science fiction writer, so that it wasn't that I abandoned my science to become a science fiction writer. I abandoned part of my science fiction because I didn't think I could make a living that way in order to study for my PhD and become a professor. I didn't think I could make a living that way either, but I figured professorship plus science fiction might enable me to support a wife and child or two. As it happened, I discovered that science fiction alone could do the job, and by 1958, I had to make a choice. I was riding two horses, and they were beginning to diverge. And if you have one foot on each, and you notice there's increasing space between, you have to quick decide which horse to jump on. And I jumped on riding. So 1958, I stopped teaching. Kept my title. I'm still professor of biochemistry at Boston University School of Medicine. And that suits the School of Medicine, you understand. They don't mind having me. And I became a full-time writer. And now I'm a full-time writer for 30 years. And it was a chance. You know, one didn't know for sure. Even if you're a successful writer, when you've got a steady job, maybe one of the reasons you're a successful writer is because you know that even if things flop and you suddenly find you can't write, you've still got something to fall back on. What happens if you abandon what you fall back on? And there you are. You've got to write steadily or your income might drop to zero. I realized at the time that the strain might be too great. But fortunately, it didn't work out that way. I love to write. I've never had writer's block in my life. I just sit down and write. And publishers humor me tremendously. I mean, anything I write, they're willing to publish. It's a wonderful feeling.
Well, of course, you're best known as a science fiction writer, but you've written all these nonfiction books and about 100 books of mystery, including the one that was very well known, A Murder at the ABA.
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, these days I write more mystery short stories than I do science fiction short stories. And I would like to give some very spectacular reason for that that would reflect upon my virtue and integrity and all the rest, but the real reason is that it's a lot easier to write mysteries than to write science fiction. I'd write mystery novels, like Murder at the ABA, by choice, but my publishers know exactly which side of the bread is buttered. And it's the science fiction novels that are bestsellers, not the mystery novels, so...
Well, that brings us up to Fantastic Voyage. Actually, the original version of Fantastic Voyage, a version of Fantastic Voyage came out a number of years ago and was based on a movie. Now, tell me about that.
Well, they made the movie Fantastic Voyage, which was based on a miniaturized submarine in the bloodstream, and came to me with a movie script and asked me to do the novelization. And there was a certain amount of reluctance on my part because I'd never done anything like that before and because I felt it was perhaps a little beneath my dignity to use someone else's imagination and just convert it into a novel. But they insisted, and it was something I'd never done before, and finally I agreed, on condition I could get a hardcover book out of it. I didn't want it to be just a throwaway. They often make novels out of movies, but it's just there to advertise the movie. The movie appears, the novel sells for a while, the movie leaves the screens, the novel dies. I wanted a hardcover so it'd be some sort of long life to it. And they agreed. And I think that Fantastic Voyage was the first movie throwaway to appear in hardcovers.
And in fact, I was talking to someone this weekend who gave me this book for you to sign, who was absolutely positive that the movie was based on your novel.
I know. I work fast. They work slow. The book came out 6 months before the movie was released, so that it seemed that way, but it wasn't. And then it turned out that the paperback was not a throwaway, which surprised them very much, the publishers, Bantam, because it kept on selling. It's selling to this day, 21 years afterwards, just as though the movie had never been made. And then someone a couple of years ago bought the rights to the title and the concept. You could write a book called Fantastic Voyage 2, and you could deal with a submarine and a bloodstream. You couldn't use the events of the first. You couldn't use the characters in the first. It could not be a sequel. So what I did was I invented a completely different situation with the title Fantastic Voyage 2 and the concept of a submarine in the bloodstream. But the story was more complicated. It's twice as long as the first book. And I think much more subtle. And I went to a great deal of effort to make it much more scientific. The people who made the movie, and I won't fault them in this, they were interested in making an exciting movie and a successful one. They did. But they, except for getting the biology fairly correct, they didn't worry about the physics of it. In fact, you could tell from internal evidence that they didn't know that matter was composed of atoms. And I couldn't allow that. So I had to make some changes in the novel, the first novel, in order to get rid of some of the worst of the faux pas. But in the second novel, I tried to be just about as scientific as one can be for miniaturization, which is a theoretical impossibility, of course.
Well, that's exactly what your hero says. It's impossible, and he's still saying it as he's being injected into the bloodstream.
That's
of
right.
This comatose Soviet scientist.
It is impossible unless you can figure out some way of reducing the value of Planck's constant, and I don't think there is any way. But of course, in the story,
that has
is.
Something to do with mass. Mass must also be reduced at the same
yes,
proportion.
Yes, everything has to be reduced. There's a natural grain to the universe, which is the size of which is defined by Planck's constant. It's like if you look at a movie photograph in the newspaper, it's made up of tiny dots of black and white, you know. And if you magnify it as much as possible, you'll just get meaningless black and whites, and you won't be able to get any more information out of it than will be allowed by those black and white dots. If you can make the black and white dots smaller, and in recent years they have, then you get clearer newspaper photographs. But always that grain sets a limit. You can't increase, magnify the photographs to show the bacteria on the skin of people, you see. And the same way, you can't miniaturize people without making the grain of the universe finer, the little black and white dots.
Did you recall all of the science from your college days, or did you have to sit down and re-research this material?
Oh, well, that's where I'm lucky. In the first place, since I'm forever writing science essays, I even have for the last year, I just completed the first year of a weekly syndicated science essay for the Los Angeles Times Syndicate. I'm forever reading up on science. But in addition to that, I've had a trick memory. I just don't forget. This may not last forever. I'm getting a little on the older side. But for now, it's very convenient.
You wrote a really interesting article several years ago for the New York Times Sunday magazine. And this dealt with atheism, and you expressed your arguments against God so well. Have you ever done a book on the... It seems almost inconsistent. You've done books on the Bible.
Yes.
At the same time, you're a professed atheist.
Well, yes, but that doesn't mean that I'm not interested in the Bible. I mean, I'm interested in the Greek myths, too, and I honestly don't believe Zeus ever existed, you see. I mean, to be interested in something and to have an inner conviction that something is true, I'm entirely different. I'm sure that when the Grimm brothers researched their folk tales and presented Grimm's fairy tales and all that, they didn't think those were true stories. So, in the same way, although I'm an atheist, I'm very interested in the Bible.
You're such a prolific writer, which shows a tremendous amount of discipline. How do you order your day?
Oh, well, actually, it's the simplest thing in the world. I just type whenever I'm not doing something else, and I do as little something else as possible. I can't avoid. I have to eat. I have to go to the bathroom. I have to sleep. I have to talk to my wife, and occasionally I have to go out and be interviewed. But whenever I'm not doing these things, which are all forced on me, then I write, and the writing is the one thing I do voluntarily. And I write for as long as I can. Eventually, I get too tired to be able to write without write sensibly, and I do it every day, including Saturdays, Sundays, holidays. And, you know, if you're interested in one thing only, and you do it all the time, you do an awful lot of it.
And you do it quite well, Isaac Asimov. It's a real treat to be able to sit down and talk to you for this short time and in such detail, because I've enjoyed your work so much over the years, and I thank you very, very much for spending this time with me.
It's been my pleasure to be here.